America loves to watch murder documentaries, listen to crime podcasts like this one, and obsess over unsolved cases. Evolutionary psychologists say that we're drawn to these tales because murder, rape, and theft have played a significant part in human society since our hunter-gatherer days. It's in our nature to be highly attuned to criminal misdemeanors, and we instinctively want to discover the who, the what, the when, and where, so we can find out what makes criminals tick to keep ourselves safe. We want to better protect ourselves and our kin. Today on Tax Crime Junkies, we look at our first cold case. 22 years after Pricewaterhouse accountant Julie Bucalo was found bound and strangled in her San Jose cottage. Find out how another PwC employee with a history of assaults against women gained access to Julie, preventing the 26-year-old on track for a CPA license from realizing her career ambitions. Welcome back, everyone, to Tax Crime Junkies. I'm your host, Dominique. I'm a CPA certified tax strategist. I have an interest in true crimes. I have a degree in law and lead the American Institute of Certified Tax Planners. And with me today is my oh-so-lovable co-host, Tom Gorzinski.
Hey, Dom. I'm Tom Gorzinski. I'm an enrolled agent. I've admitted to practice before the U.S. Tax Court as a non-attorney, and I'm a tax instructor. And like you, I have a real interest in true crime. So we decided to create a true crime podcast to combine our love of mysteries, whodunits, and tax. We are the Tax Crime Junkies. And today we've got a case that proves the quote, justice delayed is not justice denied.
Yeah, this one took a while, Tom. It took over two decades to come to a verdict. But this story is a testament to the dogged determination and the incredible advances in forensic science. So all you criminals from a long time ago, we are coming to get you.
Right you are, we are. So let's dig into the dark tale of Ralph Baldinegro, a former firefighter and current inmate whose twisted journey wound through professional disgrace, multiple assaults, and ultimately a cold-blooded murder. But before we begin, remember, this podcast is not only about dark, crime-riddled rabbit holes, but also about understanding the complexities of the tax and legal system and learning from it.
It's 1991 in Santa Clara County. Tom, I assume you were just a wee lad at that time.
Elementary school?
Okay. So maybe you remember it was a time we were jamming out to Nirvana and Bryan Adams, and The Silence of the Lambs was the horror flick to see at the time. But in San Jose, California, the horror was not on the screen. It was real life.
Imagine Julie Bucalo, a 26-year-old accountant thriving at her job at Pricewaterhouse, having no idea her life was about to end in the most horrific way possible. Ralph Baldinegro, a 42-year-old former firefighter, works as security for the firm. He's no stranger to crime, having left the Santa Clara Fire Department in disgrace a few years earlier after an assault conviction and dismissal. As we unfold this story, Dom, here is something to ponder about. What circumstances lead a person to turn from a supposed protector to a perpetrator?
Well, my tax licenses and degrees do not qualify me to answer that, but it's a good question. Perhaps as we unroll this case, we might see some signs. But let's start by addressing how old it is, because this is our very first cold case that we're covering on the show, and it took 20 years to solve. And Tom, I can't even imagine how agonizing that wait must have been for Julie's loved ones. 2 decades. That is a lifetime for some. And it was through the magic of DNA that later connected Baldinegro to the brutal murder scene at Julie's South Meridian Avenue cottage. And that's what allowed prosecutors to finally capture a dangerous, violent person and get him off the streets to avoid harming anyone else.
Indeed, it really was a tragic wait, a wait filled with questions, frustration, and heartache. Baldinegro, in the meantime, continued his pattern of violence against women, often involving handcuffs or duct tape, suffocation, and choking. Now, I'm not aware of any other murders, but I imagine the women that came after this case would have appreciated what must be horrific circumstances in their life had Baldinegro been actually locked up at the time.
Yeah, it's just chilling. Baldinegro was charged with special circumstances murder. Here in California, that means eligible for the death penalty. He also was charged with attempted rape and burglary. But the big question is, why did it take so long? Why over 2 decades to bring charges for Julie's murder? And how many more victims were there because it took so long?
Well, let's start with Julie's case, and then we'll look back on Baldinegro's history and how it was missed, and how things could have been done differently so that Julie could have had her amazing career as an accountant.
Okay. So this attractive 26-year-old accountant named Julie and 42-year-old Ralph Baldinegro, they both worked at Price Waterhouse, but they were just acquaintances. Baldinegro had left the Santa Clara Fire Department, and he did so in disgrace a few years earlier. And he was convicted of assaulting an ex-girlfriend, and that's why he was fired from the fire department. That's a story we're going to come back to shortly.
And as we said, Julie was fresh out of school and working as a staff accountant for PwC. Her boyfriend in February of 1991 was Jim Kent. Kent lived in Martinez and would often spend the weekend with Buccolo, leaving on Sunday afternoons. He visited Buccolo from Friday, February 1st, 1991, until the afternoon of Sunday, February 3rd, 1991.
So I'm assuming the date is significant, Tom. Was Jim Kent the last person to see Julie alive? You know, they always suspect the boyfriend or the partner of the victim.
Yes, they do. And yes, they did suspect him because Kent was the last person to see Julie alive.
Oh, no.
Kent tried to call Julie only to be met with the cold indifference of the answering machine. Undeterred, he dialed Buccolo's number again. One ring, two rings, machine again. Julie's cheerful voice in the recording was a stark contrast to the building worry in Kent. Monday came with an unshakable sense of unease. His calls to Buccolo kept going unanswered. Her usually active work line was lifeless. So Monday came, his calls to Buccolo still went unanswered. In a flurry of worry, Kent called the local flooring store, which was in the front of Julie's cottage. Kent and Julie's friend Nick's voice was soothing as he asked him to check on Buccolo.
So basically, he calls their friend Nick, and he asked Nick if he can just run over and see if Julie's car is parked in its parking spot. And Nick found the car. It was parked as usual, but the home was eerily silent, and her usually playful dog was forlorn in the yard. That's a bad sign. Her curtains were tightly drawn. It's a stark contrast to the vibrant, open home that she kept. And so despite Nick's attempts, the house remained stubbornly sealed. So you can just imagine, I think everybody's nerves are just getting beat at this point.
Absolutely.
A brief conversation later, Nick was edging toward the doghouse, a hesitant hand stretched out to retrieve the hidden spare keys. Don't put them in the doghouse. Everybody knows there's hidden keys in the doghouse. But Kent was a ball of worry and adrenaline on the other end, as I can imagine. I mean, Absolutely. He's got to be so nervous and helpless because he's just on the phone there. And he urged Nick to call the police instead. So Nick waits for the authorities to do the searching inside of the home. Jim Kent, the boyfriend, shows up. And here's the problem, Tom. He shows up drunk and screaming Julie's name.
Well, that's not a good thing for him to demonstrate with the police there, that's for sure.
No, it isn't. So now Jim and Nick have got the blue and red lights painting eerie shadows on Julie's house, and the reality of the situation is coming into focus. Officer after officer pulls up, each set of boots crunching on the gravel of the driveway, and that's seeming louder and louder.
And the news wasn't good, Dom. Her lifeless body was found face down on her bed. She was unclothed from the waist down. Aside from some soiled clothing, including men's items, nothing else in the house really looked out of place. Her wallet was there. It didn't look like anything was stolen. And the police did some interrogations of the boyfriend, and that's where the case got stuck for nearly 20 years.
That's where it ends? That's not very far. And did they suspect Boldenegro? Was that like a complete surprise?
Well, actually, no, he wasn't a complete surprise, because back in 1991, Julie and Boldenegro would talk as they passed each other at work every day. You know, just a hello, polite greetings, friendly chat. But it kind of heated up for Boldenegro, and he soon became infatuated with Julie. He asked her out. He brought her gifts.
Ew. So he was like a stalker, basically.
Yeah, well, that's how Julie described him to both her boyfriend and her other friends. He even coincidentally bumped into Julie on more than one occasion outside of work, which led her to believe that he was following her and stalking her. So they actually interviewed Boldenegro, but they just couldn't connect him to the crime scene, and of course he didn't confess.
So that's why it sat for so long as a cold case, because they actually did have an idea of who did it, but if they can't prove it, you know, what are they going to do? And so the case got more and more icy and dusty. So the story takes an interesting turn with a couple of unsuspecting heroes, and these heroes unfortunately suffered greatly at the hands of Ralph Boldenegro. In 2006, so this is, you know, 15 years later, two women that were listed in the court records only as Linda A. and D.M., they came forward to report being raped and assaulted by Ralph Boldenegro. Linda A. was actually living with Ralph Boldenegro, and D.M. was Linda's 14-year-old daughter.
Oh, God.
So it sounds like she, you know, lived there, too. And they got into a fight, and after the fight, Linda A. locked herself into her bedroom to get space from Boldenegro. He pounded on the door, and she was afraid, so she opened the door.
Oh, no, no. Call the police.
So you never know how you'll react, Tom, in that situation. And her kids were there. So she does that. And she opens the door and he tries to strangle Linda. And this is what Linda reported that he said to her. Ralph is saying, "I warned you that it was going to come to this. I told you this would happen." And he also said that if he could not have her, nobody else could have her, and that he was going to kill her. And the incredible thing, Tom, is that her kids saved her. Her little ones showed up And this monster would loosen his grip around her neck when the kids would come by. So needless to say, he let go, and then he apologized and asked for forgiveness, and he begged her not to go to the police. He had a gun and said he would kill himself before ever being arrested.
Oh, please don't tell me that she took him back.
No. Actually, she went to the police station. She reported it, which of course made him angry. And to make a long story short, several months later, he broke into Linda's home and he sought revenge on Linda and her daughter. Remember, we're calling the daughter DM. And he did that by beating and raping them. So this is a person that's he's a very scary individual. And the details of this assault are so horrific. We definitely cannot repeat them here.
This guy needs to get off the streets. But I'm assuming that what happened was the police were able to arrest him at this point and hopefully obtain his DNA.
Aha. This is how they got him, isn't it?
Well, this is where our story takes a turn towards the good side, Adam. These assaults showed a pattern of using handcuffs or duct tape and weapons like knives. And an investigator happened to notice the reference to Baldinegro in Julie's case file and started to get curious.
It's amazing that he actually put this together, that this investigator remembered the name Baldinegro from Julie's cold case file.
Well, remembering that Baldinegro was involved was probably the key to finally solving the case. So the police were able to take DNA from the evidence at Julie's crime scene from 1991 and then compare it against Baldinegro. Remember, they had his DNA from those assaults and it matched. But here's the rub. Despite practically a smoking gun, he pled not guilty to Julie Buccolo's case. His lawyer called the prosecution a waste of judicial resources. Now, to me, prosecuting a murderer is never a lack of resources. But the reason his lawyer said it was because Baldinegro was already serving a 94-year sentence for the attacks on the other two women. He had been convicted. He was never going to get out of jail anyway.
And that happened before the crime lab even sent the results back. So luckily, he was off the streets and in prison already. So now let's turn to Janet P. Janet P. is another person in this story. In fact, she's the ex-wife of Baldinegro. She had three children with him. And Janet claimed that he pinned her to the bed after accusing her of infidelity. Now, this happened in 1982, and he slapped her and he strangled her. He released his grip after looking at the clock and realized it was time for his exercise class, and he was going to be late. So he lets go. Janet P. took the children and went to a women's shelter for a few days.
Now, is Janet P. the one who, after leaving Baldinegro, testified she gave him a false alibi during the investigation of another crime?
Yeah, unfortunately. You know, with these cases, Tom, it's hard to judge the women in these cases, or I would just say the partner in these cases, because there's a lot of coercive control happening. And while you're saying, why would you lie and give him an alibi when he's doing this stuff to other people?
Right.
But it's hard to, unless you're in their shoes, to really understand the kind of stress that they're under. And he's a violent person. So there was actually another attack and victim here. Her name's Sarah Griffith. And she actually was once a girlfriend of Baldinegro. She claimed that he assaulted her multiple times in 1984. And these incidents bore chilling similarities to his attack on Julie Buccolo.
Yes, she was walking to her car after class one morning when the defendant grabbed her from behind and put a knife to her left breast. He said that the knife had poison on it, and he said something about killing her. Sarah screamed and pounded on a car to try to attract attention. He pulled her down to the ground. He punched her in the head a few times. He then took her bag, which had her wallet, her books, and fled. Sarah G. did report the incident to the police. At the time, they found a hair, which initially they said could not have come from Baldenegro, but then later actually said it may have come from him. Now, Baldenegro had denied assaulting Sarah G. When interviewed, Baldenegro claimed they were a couple and that she wanted to have his baby.
It's disgusting.
Yeah, her story opens a can of worms. It raises questions about how seriously the justice system took these charges against Baldenegro back then, and if Bucalo and others could have been spared the horrors they went through if the police had dealt with him more firmly and more proactively from the beginning.
Yeah, I think precisely the same thing. But we also have to remember this is 1984.
Right.
And things were different with his wife, 1982. I can imagine the police at that time probably didn't even think it was possible to rape your wife. You know, they had this different perspective on things. And we know so much more now than we did before. And even though we've got this pattern that's kind of showing what he's doing, it doesn't mean it's a slam dunk case, because there's problems with getting in all of this evidence in Julie's case. Here's a couple things. Number one, Baldenegro was never charged in the other attacks. And so even though this kind of shows, look, this guy is a bad dude.
Right.
You know, there's rules and there's laws that help protect us in our judicial system. This information was unduly prejudicial, even though he denied he did the other attacks and he just said they all wanted him. You know, all the women were onto him. But here's the main thing. It was all hearsay. It's all hearsay evidence. And so even that stalking behavior of Baldenegro, of Julie, before the crime happens, that's hearsay. Because where is the information coming from? It's coming from her friends and family that talked about how afraid she was of him. Do you want to talk a little bit about hearsay evidence, Tom, and how it protects our constitutional rights?
Yeah, I can do that. The rule against hearsay is designed to uphold important constitutional rights in a criminal trial. First, it can affect someone's right to a fair trial because hearsay evidence can tend to be unreliable or misleading. You know, it's like the game of telephone. The message starts one way, and by the end, the message doesn't match. So that's an issue. The hearsay rule also supports the due process rights of defendants. Admitting hearsay as evidence without an opportunity for the defendant challenge that evidence can be seen as inherently unfair. And finally, one of the most significant protections offered by the hearsay rule is the right to confront and cross-examine witnesses. If hearsay were allowed without limitation, it would undermine this right because the person who made the original statement would not be cross-examined by defense counsel or by the defendant.
And that makes it really difficult to get any evidence, really, that happened outside of court so that you can prove your case. But if this evidence in particular can use one of the exceptions that have been developed over time. And so when there are certain circumstances that occur, you actually can have hearsay evidence admitted under strict guidelines. And so, for example, on the idea of presenting motive, and that motive was similar in all cases, the way he's stalking, the way he's attacking his victims, if prosecutors can show the existence of a common design or a plan. And that's what they argued about, you know, all the rape and the strangulation acts in these cases. Then the evidence could be used to show a pattern in that defendant's behavior, and it should be allowed technically under the exception. And it was. It was allowed in at that time of the case. Another exception is allowed when you're using hearsay evidence to show someone's state of mind at the time. And we saw this with her friends and her family all saying Julie was afraid of Baldinegro.
Exactly. So the court allowed this evidence to be admitted at trial. And these rulings held up under appeal. The appellate court agreed with the lower court's ruling. So listeners, what do you think about the justice system's handling of the earlier assaults? And what about the benefits of DNA evidence in cold cases? And let's not forget the role of investigators, particularly in Buccolo's case. Once the DNA evidence was found linking Baldinegro to Buccolo, it was clear who her killer was.
That's why I say, Tom, we are coming for those criminals. You know, there are millions of DNA samples in evidence rooms across the country. They just need to be tested and compared. And law enforcement is coming for you, criminals. And the system worked. The jury needed only a few hours to find Ralph Baldinegro guilty in the 1991 slaying. He was 64 now by the time he's convicted. And remember, Julie, back in 1991, she was a 26-year-old accountant. And Baldinegro will definitely spend the rest of his life in prison. He's serving that sentence on top of the 94-year sentence he got in the previous case.
And we haven't even covered all of his crimes, Dominique. This guy is a bad guy. In 2006, he broke into his ex-wife's house, beat and tied up his 14-year-old stepdaughter, and struck and handcuffed his estranged wife before snatching his son and fleeing in a 1998 gold Saturn station wagon. The CHP, the California Highway Patrol, chased Baldinegro for about half an hour, and at one point had to deploy spike strips in front of the car to deflate the tires. He eventually stopped the car, he surrendered, and the son was found unharmed.
Listen, and this is how he treats his loved ones, right?
Exactly. I personally am glad he's locked away for good. We are all safer for it.
Right. So today our lessons are, one, the importance of thorough investigation, and my hat is off for the investigator in this case that connected the dots, and especially DNA testing. Number two, never underestimate the power of safety measures. We recommend employers do complete background checks. Had they looked into this man's background, they would have seen this former firefighter that was let go because he had committed these other acts. And had they done that, they probably would not have hired him, and Julie might be still alive today, and she would be over 60 years old herself. And three, finally, that justice, no matter how delayed it is, can still be served.
This case is really heartbreaking. But it does show the importance of perseverance, of never giving up on seeking justice, no matter how long it takes. It also emphasizes the importance of continually developing and improving our justice system so that cases can be solved swiftly and families don't have to endure such long waits for justice.
Well said. And on that note, we end today's episode. Let's all reflect on the victims in this case, especially our accountant, Julie, who never really got a chance to live her life. We'll be back with another thrilling and thought-provoking tale next week. Until then, stay curious, stay vigilant, and always seek the truth. Thanks for tuning in to Tax Crime Junkies.
Thank you for listening. We're very grateful you decided to join us today, and we hope you consider subscribing to the show and sharing it with friends who could use a Tax Crime Junkie podcast in their life. Help us spread the word and come back for more.
We hope you'll join us again next week as we continue our mission to find the loopholes that went left and close them for good. Until next time, remember, every crime has a trail that leads to the truth.